Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Here now, another story selected from the pages of Asimov's science fiction magazine.
Filaments, read and written by Mercurio de Rivera, explores a tragic accident, a troubled relationship, and the terrifying mystery that lies at the heart of an abandoned alien planet. Enjoy our appropriately September-October selection, Filaments.
Below us, along the prime meridian, sits a twilit paradise where the sun is forever setting. To the west, it's an endless day. To the east, perpetual night. I clutch the armrests as our shuttle breaks through roiling red clouds and the narrow isthmus connecting Tranquility's two continents grows larger in the viewscreen. Emerald green waves crash against the coastlines. The abandoned Escondido colony comes into view. Only a few empty structures remaining. Standard habs, printed from regolith and chitin, the kind you'd see on any colony world in the Proxima system. The shuttle lurches, its landing jets throttling as we set down on the beach. I descend the ramp, and Sebastian, who's piloting, nods goodbye to me. A minute later, the shuttle shoots off into the dark red clouds. I shoulder my backpack and pull down my cap to shield myself from the cool drizzle striding into the steady wind. Along the shore lie long strings of slimy filaments, supposedly the byproduct of magnesium sulfates in the ocean water. At least that was the theory exogeologists gave lip service to before the incidents started, before IPC's evacuation order changed everything. My heartbeat quickens as I kneel to scoop up a sample. The protoplasmic filaments extend for kilometers along the shoreline, at some points jutting out into knobby projections, at other junctures branching off into odd, snowflake-shaped extensions that connect to long sections sneaking into the ocean. I shake my head. To think, we once considered the filaments nothing more than alien seaweed. I break off a strand, mash it into a stasis tube, and seal it up. The substance clings to the tube's interior like mucus-lined kelp. I suppress a wave of nausea and jam the vial into my pocket. A year ago, this beach swarmed with bustling crowds from space station. Vacationing families, teenage surfers hanging ten in the Viridian waves. How many times had Javi and I sat on this very spot, building sandcastles? Now the Western Ocean washes across barren sands. So much time, so much effort, all flushed down the drain. I hike inland until I arrive at the Thousand Fingers. The 6-foot sandstone pillars on the colony's outskirts. A worn dirt path between the wind-blown rock formations leads me to open flatlands. Half a kilometer away, I spot the lights of our hab on a hilltop where Annie waits. Sebastian had dropped her off yesterday after she'd declined my offer to share a shuttle. Given everything that's happened, I'm not sure I can bear to be with her again, especially here, where we'd spent so much time together as a family. She'd left the hab light on for me, at least. Before I can knock, the door opens. Marcelo, Annie says. I saw the shuttle land. She has a buzz cut and no makeup on. Annie, I say. Did you get the sample, she says. I nod, patting my pocket. Good, I couldn't even bring myself to look at it, steps aside. I drop my pack by the door and scan the living room. Random items are spread across the floor. Old swim trunks and bikinis, a snorkeling flipper, a broken hydro board, an oar, a coffee-stained shirt from Abierto she'd gotten me for my birthday. Beach clothes, all sorted in separate piles, his and hers. So much for tackling this particular task together. I got started on our bedroom, she says. I hope you don't mind. Why would I mind? I say, trying to keep the annoyance out of my voice. Tranquility registers my irritation. Thunder rumbles. And a few seconds later, the patter of raindrops changes into a steady downpour. The vial thrums in my pocket. I stand in front of bay windows that frame the Western Ocean. During the summer, these waters sparkle a bright lime green. Now the ocean is darker, gray-green flecked with whitecaps. Annie stares out the window at the gathering storm, a trace of fear in her eyes. "Relax, will you?" she says. "Take a deep breath." I focus on my breathing. I didn't mean to upset you," she says. They're mostly my things." She points to different sized piles, one twice as large as the other. "You can go through them if you want." I don't answer. Instead, I head into the interior bedroom, Javi's room, and toss my windbreaker into the bed. The room is still in disarray, exactly as we left it last summer when the evacuation order sent us scrambling off-world and back to space station. "So how was your flight?" she asks breezily. I can tell she's still trying to calm me down. I don't blame her. On this newly awakened world, it's dangerous for me, for anyone, to stay angry. I make a conscious effort to redirect my thoughts. I tell her about the clandestine takeoff from space station. IPC had discontinued all shuttles to Tranquility, so I had to call in some favors, as Annie had, to arrange this final unsanctioned visit. Sebastian, our old lab partner, had come through for us, piloting the shuttle here. "There was terrible turbulence," I say. "We had to descend through an electrical storm." My breathing steadies, and outside, the rain lets up slightly. As I speak, Annie casually taps a pleasure nodule just below her ear. I glare at her. Even after everything that's happened between us, she still has no qualms about using in front of me. A bolt of lightning flashes, and we both flinch. Fear fills her eyes. I'm sorry about the nodule. I know you don't like me using it, but I have a toothache." She rubs her hand against the right side of her jaw. "I postponed treatment to come here. The nod helps manage the pain." I've heard her litany of excuses for years, but this is a new one. The wind howls. I need to control myself, so I inhale deeply and again shift my thoughts elsewhere. "Sebastian is picking us up tomorrow at noon sharp," I say, "so we'd best get to work. We only have a brief window before the automated disinfector ships arrive to perform final cleanup." "Speaking of cleanup," she says with a sad smile, "this place is a mess." The floor of Javi's room resembles a miniaturized crash site with scattered pieces of a toy space station. Smart action figures lay strewn about like corpses. "I was always telling him to clean up his room," she says, picking up a snow globe of Titan I'd bought Javi last summer. "I had to enforce the rules." Her face hardens. "Someone had to." "Don't start," I say. Her nostrils flare and I brace for more, but instead she takes a deep breath and the anger on her face dissipates as quickly as it had appeared, like a wave crashing against the shore, then retreating. "You're right," she says, voice steady, casually tapping her nod. "No point picking at scabs." She shakes the snow globe, watching the miniature blizzard swirl above the tiny dunes. "If we're going to clear this place out by tomorrow, we should get started. Let's finish the other rooms first, and the closets." We spend the next hour tossing ocean nav equipment, e-readers, thermal swimsuits, beach clothes, and other random items into bags marked his, hers, and incineration. The incineration bag is the biggest. "I don't like the way we left things," Annie says after a long silence. But the last time I'd seen her in person, she'd served me with divorce papers, setting off a firestorm of mutual, angry recriminations. Yet we couldn't seem to find a way to cut off our connection. We'd continued communicating via video links and holo messages in a constant state of war. After our last blow-up, I thought I'd never see her again. But when I let slip, I was planning to return to Escondido to find something of Javi's to take back with me, a keepsake. She'd insisted on joining me. "This isn't the time to hash all that out," I say. "Not here." "No, you're right." The discovery of microscopic life at the bottom of the icy Eastern Ocean, a type of hibernating flatworm, had prompted conservation groups on Earth and across the settled colonies to petition IPC to preserve the natural environment and leave Tranquility. The evacuation order followed shortly thereafter, and eventually the disinfector ships will eliminate every last trace of humanity's presence, restoring the world to its natural state. While the protests by the preservationists were the official reason given for abandoning Tranquility, Annie and I know better. We're fleeing because of the damned filaments, because they forced us off their world. "Taking this sample off-world," she says, "if word were to get out, I'll store the stasis vial in a special compartment in the biosafety lab," I say. No one on space station will know, not even Sebastian. I just needed proof. Proof of what really happened here, for myself. Do you understand? You don't need to convince me, but I hated lying to Sebastian, she says somberly, laying her hand on my forearm. I did tell him you were coming here to collect some of Javi's things, which is true, I say. And the part about retrieving the filament sample just slipped your mind, she says. I'm not sure if she's taking a dig at me, but then she smiles. Marcelo, our time together, I don't want her to go there. It wasn't all bad, was it? She says. I shake my head. Of course not. There's a familiar soft glint in her eyes, and all the hostility between us melts away in an instant. At that moment, the sound of the falling rain fades. That's why I hope we can still... I don't want to say still be friends. That's unrealistic, she says. But I hope we can say goodbye with some measure of respect for what we had, what we shared. I'm about to agree when she pulls a pair of Javi's blue flip-flops from beneath the bed. Time stands still. She presses the rubber soles against her chest, and I feel a weight in my own chest, as if the blood pumping through my heart is frozen. We keep cleaning. On an upper closet shelf, I find a rolled-up canvas, a charcoal sketch of Javi you've been meaning to frame. The drawing captures his thick eyebrows and round face, his mischievous smile. One of our neighbors, a colonist with a passion for sketching, had drawn it while Javi and I sculpted a sandcastle on the beach. While the neighbor drew the sketch, Annie had reclined in a beach chair, sipping a cocktail, one of the rare times she'd taken off from work to join us. When I saw her surreptitiously tapping a pleasure nod, I marched over and slapped the nod off her temple, setting off one of our more spectacular fights. I want it, she says, pulling the canvas from my hands. Of course you do. I retreat into the kitchen. The hab lights flicker and the vial in my pocket twitches again. I pull out the stasis tube. The filament inside has solidified into a rod with serrated spikes, spinning and scraping against the glass. I hear a soft sobbing, no, a gasping, and when I return to the living room, Annie's staring at the front door. Then I hear it. Something outside is rubbing against the wooden frame. I step forward, unlatch the lock, and yank open the door. A gust of wind shoves me backward. And out of the corner of my eye, I spot movement, something snaking between the rock spires. When I blink, it's gone. A moment later, a powerful stench of rotting eggs fills the room. I slam the door shut and clamp my hand over my mouth to keep from puking. Ugh, what the hell, Annie says. The approaching electrical storm, it can generate a strong sulfuric smell. We wind up sitting side by side on the couch, my hand pressed over my nose, while Annie cups her right cheek and says, my molar is killing me. It's Annie's idea to take a break and go on a shore hike, a daily ritual we'd observed during happier times. She wears a hooded blue jumpsuit with sandals, and I make do with my windbreaker and a baseball cap. The rain has slackened to a drizzle. We started these jaunts in the perpetual dusk when we made Escondido our summer retreat 3 years ago, when Javi was only 6. We would stroll between the red sandstone pinnacles of Thousand Fingers down to the crowded beach, where vendors sold cheesy, ensconced in Escondido t-shirts and memory pods to the vacationing colonists. As Javi grew older, he'd look forward to our hikes more than we did, mostly because he enjoyed playing with the other children gathered on the shore. Annie once remarked she found our trek through the Thousand Fingers spooky, and after that I always told her tales of hombres lobos dragging helpless victims into the rock woods to feast on human flesh. Javi loved the scary stories and added silly details of his own to try to frighten his mom. But the stories made Annie laugh. How I loved her laugh. Now, we hike the desolate shore, stepping over endless ribbons of filaments, hollow pebbles crackling beneath our feet like peanut shells. It's the cool, rainy season now, the time of year when colonists would normally have retreated to Abierto, the settlement about 1,000 kilometers to the north where it was summer. Although tidally locked, Tranquility's eccentric orbit resulted in long, gradually changing seasons, summers bleeding into autumns almost imperceptibly. But now Abierto is evacuated too. So many exobiologists, she says, so many great minds, and we couldn't see what was staring us right in the face. She kneels as if to touch one of the filaments, but pulls her hand away at the last moment. All the evidence, I say, pointed to non-biological processes. Staring at the filaments now, I recognize their familiar patterns. The protoplasmic ribbons rise up from the ocean floor and stretch along the shore, branching off into extensions which either connect to other filaments or taper off and lay buried in the sands. Even the buried ones, I'm certain, are connected to other filaments below ground. Look at the arborization, I say, pointing to the complex branching patterns. It all seems so obvious now. Typical dendrites, axons. All part of a vast neural network, she says, shaking her head. Neurofilaments so sensitive they can detect and feed off of the slightest electrical impulses, even the flickers inside a human brain. The colonists had trampled over the filaments as if they were alien kelp. But once awakened, it was the filaments that rode roughshod over all of us, feeding off of our emotions, making us pay dearly for daring to step foot onto this world. As Annie and I continue our hike, we spot one particularly jagged rock formation jutting out of the surf like a scythe. Behind it, a blanket of blood-red clouds stretches into the pink horizon, fading into a line of gray and black. The other side of the world remains sheathed in darkness. Only the complex circulation patterns of warm air and ocean currents from dayside to nightside, combined with the planet's powerful magnetic field, keeps the atmosphere intact. Clouds continually freeze over in the east, only to be reborn in the west. The prime meridian remains tropical, in a perpetual dusk often described as romantic. But there's a fine line, I've come to believe, between romance and gloom. Annie flinches and holds her hand against her jaw. Your tooth, I say? Still throbbing, she says. She stays quiet for a long while. Do you remember how afraid Javi was of losing his baby teeth? This was news to me. Was he? He was terrified, she says flatly. He was afraid of losing parts of himself. If his teeth could fall out, he said, what might be next? That's an odd thing for a child to say. It sounds like another one of those silly fears you encouraged, I say. Like his fear of the dark, of being alone. She hesitates, clears her throat. Remember when he was 7 and his tooth dangled from his gums for about a week? She rubs her jaw. You finally convinced him to trust you, to let you feel the tooth. Then once you had your fingers clamped around it, you didn't let go until you pulled it out. Not a memory I'm proud of. I'll always remember the look of betrayal on Javi's face as he sobbed, blood trickling down his chin while Annie led him into the bathroom. I stood there alone, staring at the bloody baby tooth in the palm of my hand. I'm surprised you were there for that, I say, and not at work. Annie and I have had so many intimate conversations during these hikes that we've fallen into our old pattern. I wish I'd stayed back at the Hab. Hoping to discourage the conversation, I pick up the pace, so I'm a few steps ahead of her, but she catches up. Why do you always do that? She asks, breathing hard. Do what? Launch a verbal grenade, then retreat. All those times you dropped nasty little comments about my career, all your underlying hostility, the passive aggressiveness. I never said anything, but it drove me crazy, she says, clenching her fist and looking up at the sky. That's right, I snap. You never said anything. It feels as if she's gut punched me. She's right, of course. I'd helped her get an entry-level position at Encelicor, and in just a few years, Annie had leapfrogged me to head up colony logistics for exobiology. If not for her, I'd still be stuck in a lab somewhere in the company's North American headquarters. Her promotion and assignment to the Proxima system had made it possible for us to afford to alternate between living at Space Station and spending summers at Escondido. It also gave me the freedom to cut back on my work duties and spend more time relaxing, taking care of Javi and teaching the colony kids to surf. Annie holds her sandals in her hands and strides out into the surf up to her ankles. I follow a few feet behind her, just out of reach of the waves. A bolt of lightning zigzags across the cloudy sky, and she redirects her gaze from me to the churning ocean. I follow her eyes to a blur bobbing in the waves, something I can't quite identify. It's wrapped in gunk, crusted over with hollowed out pebbles, floating about 20 meters from shore. What is that? She says. The rain intensifies and the waves reach out and splash against my shins. I lose my footing in the receding sands, and he grabs my elbow. Careful, the riptide is strong. The next wave brings it closer. A coagulation of mud, filament fragments, shards of sandglass and detritus, in the shape of a human body. A rotten stench cuts through the saltwater breeze. I can't look away. Let's go, Annie says, but neither of us moves. The ocean heaves, making the thing flail like a struggling swimmer. A high-pitched wail pierces the thrum of the ocean surf. I'm frozen. Annie is also fixated on the struggling form, human-shaped but not even remotely human. The next wave swallows it. I stand there, paralyzed, my heart in my throat, cold sweat mingling with the rain streaking down my face. What the hell was that? Annie pulls on my arm and we turn and run full tilt. We race across the shore, winding our way through the sandstone spires. I'm only a few steps ahead of her, but when I look back, I can't see her. I've lost the trail. I'm cutting between pillars, running in circles. Annie, I scream. Marcello? I hear her faintly. I'm lost in the maze, but I follow her voice, weaving between the spires until I finally hit the open plain where she's waiting for me. Together, we jog back to the Hab, leaving long shadows in our wake. We make a tacit pact not to speak of what we just witnessed. It's not because I don't want to talk about it. I do, I just can't find the words. And if we did, we might lose control of our emotions, which is what we know the Tranquility wants. After the flatworms came out of hibernation, in the depths of the Eastern Ocean, everything on the planet changed. Tranquility awakened. More filaments washed the shore, a vast spider web stretching around the globe, dark side to light side. The weather became turbulent, skies shifting from clear to stormy in an instant, as mercurial as the mood of the vacationers. Then the incidents started. A woman's corpse was found lying in the rock spires, as if ripped to shreds by the hombres lobos in the stories I'd told Annie, bits of filament found in her open wounds. Then the accident with Javi followed. Tranquility itself seemed to sense strong emotions, our fears, our anger, and fed off of them. What we had seen in the ocean just a few minutes ago was a blurred outline. It was unnatural, as if it didn't belong on this or any world. I push away the memory as we change into dry clothes and turn back to the final task of clearing out our son's room. Annie pulls all of Javi's tech toys from the chest and hands them to me one by one, and I drop them into the expandable garbage bags marked for incineration. Remember this, she says, holding up a math cube in the palm of her hand. When she presses a large red button on one side, multiplication and division problems flash on the other side. I nod. You ask them, how much is 12 times 2, and do you remember his response? Annie asks. Why, don't you know? Annie laughs. The sound transports me to the first time I met her on Margarita Island off the coast of Venezuela. The American with the luminous smile vacationing with her two sisters. I joined them, doing shots by the pool, and all three flirted with me. But the next day only Annie returned and signed up for my surfing class. Class led to dinner, and dinner led to lovemaking on a pool chaise in the wee morning hours. Afterwards, we cooled off in the chlorinated water, under the moonlight. And after she flew back to the States, we stayed in touch via holochats until I flew to Charleston the next year for a visit and we picked up right where we'd left off. I told her about my dream of working in an exobiology lab for Encelicor, which had been authorized by IPC to lead colonization efforts in the Proxima system. She'd encouraged me to pursue my dream, but somehow it had turned out all wrong. Do we have anything to eat in this place? She says. I spotted a couple of canisters of Gel Pro in the cupboard, I say. She shrugs. A few minutes later, I'm stirring a pot of protein stew on the warmers when she steps into the kitchen carrying an old holo reader she's dug out of the back of the closet. She sets it down on the table and scrolls through the images, Javi's life unspooling in stop motion from infancy to Little League to Sandcastle Builder, an unfinished movie. She settles on a holo of Javi and me standing in our day glow swim trunks next to canoes on the shore of the Western Ocean. She taps repeatedly at her nod, but it does her no good. She trembles as a quiet sob escapes her lips. I place my hand on her shoulder, but she shrugs it off. Don't! I lurch back, banging my elbow against the pot, sending it crashing to the floor. Stew scalds my ankle. God damn it, I shout. I rush to the bathroom and find some antibiotic gauze, which I wrap around my ankle. That's when I hear a soft banging in the toilet. I lift the lid. The blue-tinged sanitary gel is mostly evaporated. But bobbing inside the bowl is a half-foot piece of filament in the shape of an outstretched hand. How in the hell? I slam the lid and hit the button, flushing the filament down into the tank. After a moment, I check again. It's gone. A trail of translucent slime, the only sign it was ever there. When I go back into the kitchen, Annie stands there, her finger pressing down on the knob again and again. I feel contempt and disgust rising up like a wave. She catches my expression. "You know why I need it now," she says, her eyes brimming with tears. "The toothache," I say. "Well, yes, but no, it's mostly you. Being near you. Especially here," she says. "So I'm responsible for your addiction?" "Will you listen for once," she says. "I'm talking about how insane this all is. I came to find something of hobbies to take back with me. I knew we'd only be here a short while, but it's not safe without a nod. You know that. You should have one too." A pounding on the front door startles us both. The knocking is a steady metronomic beat. Whack, whack, whack. "Now look what you've done," Annie whispers. I try to square the knocking with the fact we're the only two people on this world. We move towards the sound together. The beat is perfectly synchronized. Whack, 2 seconds. Whack, 2 seconds. Whack. I touch the door handle. Deep in the pit of my stomach, I know whatever's out there, I shouldn't let it in. But I want to. It's feeding off of my emotions. I know this. But at the same time, intensifying my feelings in a feedback loop. "Don't," Annie mouths, shaking her head. I withdraw my hand and step toward the window, where I raise the shades. Instead of rain-splattered glass in the darkness of the Western Ocean, a thick layer of neurofilaments coats the plexi. The protoplasm is speckled with tiny black pebbles, shards of rock-like bone. I lean in for a closer look. Not bone. Teeth. Baby teeth. "What the hell?" I say, stepping back. "Look!" And he points at the front door. A ribbon of filament wriggles underneath the door. Then another. They slither like translucent snakes struggling to squeeze inside. I pull Annie into Javi's room, which is in the center of the hab, the only room with no windows. She slams the door behind us. "Get a hold of yourself," Annie says. "No, you need to calm down," I say. The wind screams and the roof creaks as if it might come flying off. "The stuff on the window," Annie says, "it looks like what we saw in the ocean earlier." "That body floating in the ocean," I say. "The filaments are trying to provoke us." "Don't you think I know that?" "But I'm afraid," she taps on her nod. "Afraid I can't control my emotions." "We'll be okay," I say. She seems as unconvinced as I sound. Glass shatters in the living room. "The window," she says. We sit with our backs pressed against the bedroom door. The wind yowls like a wounded creature, almost as if it's calling for us to come out and help it. In the other room, we hear chairs topple over. Then a crash as something heavy, the kitchen table, is hurled against the wall. Something moves beneath us. A filament squeezes underneath the door, slithers up Annie's arm and into her mouth. She gags and grabs the strand in both hands, spitting up blood. Before I can help her, a tendril wraps around my wrists, and a sharp pain stings my hand. Ow! It bites me, sinking into my flesh like hot wire, and I pull the thing off, ripping it apart. Blood runs across my skin where it's touched me. Annie screams as the filament in her mouth retreats, clutching a crimson tooth. We leap to our feet and stomp wildly on the flailing tendrils. The door convulses, and I reach back and grab the leg of Javi's bed. Together, we pull the bed up against the door and retreat to the far side of the room. The door continues shaking in its frame. "Call Sebastian," Annie says. Blood pours down her chin. "Get him down here." I pull the comm from my inside jacket pocket and try to connect to space station. The storm is interfering with the link. The lights flicker and go out. She squeezes my forearm. "Do you feel it?" "I do." There's a buzzing inside my head like an electric current, swallowing my fear, my anger, yet generating more in the process. "It's going to be okay," I say. Annie and I press against each other and her breath warms my face. She taps her nod. I pull out the vial from my pocket, and together we watch the sample twitch wildly. "We had a beautiful family," she says, locking eyes with me. "Don't forget that." Sitting with our backs against the wall, staring at Javi's bed, I remember all the times Annie read to him at bedtime. I'd occasionally barge in and start a pillow fight, making Javi shriek while Annie scolded us with a huge grin on her face. Now we hold on to each other, our hearts racing, beating in sync. And after a few minutes, as we calm down, the sample stops squirming, and the door quits rattling. I'm swimming the depths of the Western Ocean, in the dusk's dimness, in a panic. I can't find Javi. Only the beam of my flashlight disturbs the uninterrupted darkness, illuminating 10 feet ahead of me. I try to slow down, but I'm in the grip of a powerful current carrying me forward. When I stare up to the surface, I see no moonlight, no starlight, only the bleeding of black into gray. I shine my light on the ocean floor and spy movement, but there's nothing, only a stone strangely shaped like a crab. I'm moving too fast. Javi, I scream over and over. I reach up and touch my mouth and realize I'm not wearing an oxy mask. Everywhere I shine the light, there is nothing, nothing. Even the ocean floor has disappeared. I kick my legs and swim up towards the gray, trying to find the surface. The flashlight shines on a pitch black silhouette against the grayness. He's only 6 feet from the surface, but his right ankle is entangled in a filament. He reaches down, trying to break free, but can't. He attempts to scream, but only a stream of gurgling bubbles escapes his mouth. His outstretched hand reaches for the surface. It's so close, but his panic prompts the filament to squeeze more tightly. I'm here, Javi. This is a dream, I realize, and I can change things in my dream. He won't have to die alone in the dark in an alien ocean. I can save him. I try to glide toward him, but I can't move. Something is grabbing at me. I'm forced to watch the increasing panic on his face as he inhales water. He opens his mouth and his teeth crumble and fall out, jagged pieces floating around his head in a cloud of blood. He's staring at me, begging me to save him. I try to move, to break free of whatever's holding me in place, but I can't. I can't. I pull away from the arms clutching at me and gasp. Where am I? Then I remember. Daylight leaks from beneath the bed. The sky is clear. When I stand up and push the bed to one side, Annie stirs and stands. I open the door and orange daylight blinds me. Glass shards crunch beneath my feet. There's no sign of the filaments, only a rain-soaked floor, overturned furniture, broken windows. I survey the damage. Marcello, I could hear it calling to me. It wanted me to give in to my anger. She pauses. You can tell from the look on my eyes that I heard it too. I spot something inside her ear and fish it out with my pinky before she swats my hand away. A tiny piece of filament, translucent and dead. We both stare at it for a long moment. We spend the next hour silently filling up the expandable bags with random items and keepsakes. My scalded ankle throbs and the welts on my hand ache dully. Out of habit, I move the trash to the dumpster outside, although there's no need to do so. Soon, the fleet of automated disinfector ships will swoop over the colony and incinerate not only the abandoned habs, but also every last vestige of humanity's presence on this world, down to the molecular level. We carry very little with us when we stand on the beach, under a vermilion sky, waiting for Sebastian to pick us up. My backpack is full of holo-readers with images of Javi I've promised to copy and transmit to Annie. She hauls a small duffel bag over her left shoulder while clutching the rolled-up canvas in her right hand. It's strangely quiet without the wind. There's only the western ocean's soft, swishing waves. I have the sample now. Proof of what really happened here. The global neural network of filaments had wreaked so much havoc on the colony, but I've broken its spell. The feelings consuming me since I arrived have dissipated. I've been blaming Annie for everything, but my anger was a crutch, I realize, a way for me to avoid taking responsibility for my own part in the events leading up to Javi's death. I don't have any illusions about our divorce. It will be brutal, but I'm hopeful we can find a way to end our marriage without inflicting more pain on each other. This is where you taught Javi to swim, she says, gesturing to the open ocean. She had a lost, faraway look in her eyes. He picked it up so easily. He was fearless when it came to the water. He got that from you. I didn't want him to grow up to be one of those people who let irrational fears control their lives, I say. Like me, she says. Well, you got your wish, but did you ever stop to think if he'd been more afraid, he might have shown better judgment? Here it is. Finally. The moment I've been dreading since I returned to tranquility. You're blaming me for the accident, I say softly. The sky rumbles. Which is unfair because you're totally blameless, right? She says, scoffing. The wind picks up and a dark red cloud bank appears in the horizon. All I did was teach him to swim, I say. I don't blame you for the swimming lessons, you idiot. I blame you for picking a fight with me that day, she says. I argued with you because what little time you spent with us you were always using, I say, pointing to the nod by her left ear. I needed the extra bump to cope with work stress, to deal with your resentment for everything I've accomplished. Do you know what it's like bearing all the responsibility for keeping our family afloat? No, of course you don't. Checked out our marriage a long time ago, Marcelo. Admit it. That's how you rationalize turning your back on me, on Javi? She charges at me. You're pathetic, she says, standing nose to nose with me, a strand of wet hair plastered against her forehead like a scar. She says, if Javi hadn't overheard us fighting, if he hadn't run away to the beach, in a marriage marked by so many fights, we'd had our nastiest argument that day. She'd threatened to take every cent we'd earned within Selicor to seek sole custody of Javi. She promised I'd never see him again. And in that moment, I told myself I'd never let it happen. I swore I'd see my son dead first before I'd let her take him away from me. I never spoke the words out loud, but I'd spoken them in my thoughts, in my heart, and someone, something, had heard. Colony Rescue recovered Javi's body 2 days later. He'd gotten tangled up in filaments only a few feet below the surface of the water. A freak accident, they said. My baby would still be alive if not for you, Annie says, nostrils flared, her face red with rage. Did you really think I could ever forgive you for that? If you hate me so much, I say, why did you even come here? She doesn't answer, but I know the reason. We're locked in an endless battle of blame, Annie and I, unable to break our connection as much as we might want to, as much as we might need to. If you hadn't used, I shout, if you hadn't made so many goddamn threats, if you'd only been a little less selfish, yes, he'd still be alive. The vial in my pocket jackhammers against my thigh. That's when I spot something on the horizon, to the west. Sebastian's shuttle skimming just above the surface of the ocean. Finally, it can't come soon enough. I turn away from her and stride to the edge of the beach. As soon as we'd begun to argue, the dark clouds had thickened and the rain had started to fall. Now we're standing in a torrential downpour, and as the ship draws closer, lightning crackles across the black sky and the wind screams. Waves in the distance grow larger and larger. Soon they're the size of undulating hills, then small mountains. What the hell? They're tsunamis of protoplasm and filaments and teeth. A tendril shoots out of the ocean, whips across the sky, striking the ship, slicing it in half. The two sections plummet into the ocean and explode. Seconds later, the sound of a million teeth grinding on metal reverberate through the air. Sebastian, Annie screams, but I can barely hear her in the roaring wind. The vial in my pocket explodes, and filaments ooze out of my pocket and down my leg. The tsunami accelerates toward shore, occluding the sky, a giant shadow falling over us. There's no escape from it, her expression says, her white-hot anger dissolving into terror, then resignation. And I know she's right. She turns away from me and rushes 10 steps into the ocean. No, Annie, don't! I leap and tackle her, and we tumble over and over in the surf. I stare up at the looming wave, bracing for impact. And at the last second, impossibly, it parts and passes around us, picking up speed as it reaches the shore. It breaks against the sandstone pillars and crashes over the Habs. Glass explodes. Structures crumble, and when the wave recedes, nothing remains but a field of debris. Collapsed spires, Hab walls, pieces of furniture, a shattered snow globe. I kneel in the sands, numb, drenched, expecting another wave to surge and rush at us. Instead, the rain lets up, the clouds part, and the waves calm. A patch of red sky appears. We're safe. Somehow we're safe. But Annie has a vacant expression on her face. She shakes her head. I follow her eyes, which are fixed on the sky. There is no escape. On the horizon, a ship plunges through a cloud. No, not one ship. It's a fleet of ships. And from their synchronized descent and bright yellow color, I know they're automated. Disinfector ships. Annie stares at me as if searching for the right words, the right feelings. We lock eyes. I'm searching as well, but for the first time in my life, I feel nothing.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.